Jodur.
Roots, a 24-hour radio broadcast marathon on Palestinian ecology and solidarity.
يبث أيام 29 و 30 11 من الساعة 11 صباحا وحتى الساعة 11 مساء بتوقيت فلسطين.
Listen live on radio EE.net, radio Alhala and spatial radio.live.
جذور عمل إذاعي منتج بالتعاون مع راديو EE.net,
Berset University, Radio Alhara
و Special Radio CSM London و Disarming Design في معهد سامبرغ.
Hello, we are now broadcasting from London. I'm here with Dima Suji, who is an incredible architect and maker and thinker and filmmaker, literally everything under the sun. We're here to talk today. And I'd love if you could talk a little bit more about yourself and give a little more context to the people who don't know who you are, to what you do and the kinds of projects you've worked on.
Sure. Thank you, Ria. It's an honor to be here and thank you for the invitation. I just want to give a visual kind of context to the listeners, wherever they're from. We're kind of sitting in this CSM, the Central St. Martin studio, with like two massive Palestinian flags that people can look over into the foyer. And I've never seen something like this in London, with like massive signs in the lobby that say in solidarity with Palestine. So thank you for doing that and hosting this event. Just a little bit of background about me. I am an architect by background and training, and moved to London just a couple of months ago to lead the MA City Design Studio at the Royal College of Art, where we're looking at archaeological sites as a site of urban struggle in Palestine. But before I get into that, my practice kind of starts with my personal experience growing up in Palestine and kind of growing up being obsessed with objects and collecting things from my backyard and from archaeological sites in Palestine, like the Solomon pools in Nartas, that my mom was working on renovating when we were growing up. And so collecting things like fossils and seashells and wildflowers, but also dangerous things like leftover gas canisters and bullets were also part of my collection at home. And so having this kind of strange intimacy with a collection that I curated in my childhood bookshelf kind of stayed with me. So thinking of objects that I collected in my childhood became part of my practice later on. Looking back at it, it makes sense to have these objects as kind of intimate companions in some way, or emotional companions with me today. But what that looks like in my practice is a series of glass-blown objects, shedding light on the history of glass through contemporary form. Working with not only glassblowers, but archaeologists and anthropologists and even sound artists to shed light on how objects can, well, using objects also as a vessel to tell those stories with the help of those experts. So over the last few years, I moved back to Palestine in 2016 after living abroad for 15 years. And part of that practice then started then. In 2016, I started working with Riwaq, a conservation NGO that looks at 50 villages in Palestine and tries to conserve and renovate them. And through that work, I met with the glassblowers that I now work with. And a lot of the work that we did then was also more personal, where I actually was able to visit the villages in Palestine that I didn't really grow up knowing, like Jaba and Jib and parts of Jerusalem that I had never gone to. And I think there was this awareness for me for the first time that our rural spaces and our archaeological sites are very core to our landscape, and they're very important, critical part of our resistance movement, mostly because I realized how they were weaponized. So for example, we know the stories of Silwan today in Jerusalem, where the dispossession of the Palestinian families is happening because of this obsession with archaeology and how archaeology is used as a tool for the occupation there and for further dispossession of the Palestinian families from their homes. And, you know, there's hundreds of millions of dollars that are donated to settler organizations like Elad that create a tourist attraction around those archaeological sites. So my research kind of developed from looking at glassblowing as a material, and moving into not only the history of glass through an archaeological lens and kind of really examining the history of archaeology through the material of glass, but also thinking about how archaeology itself as a discourse is weaponized and deployed for further occupation, not only in Jerusalem, but also in the West Bank, in Area C, in Gaza, and so on. So this is, you know, multi-scalar work. Glass blowing is part of it, but also plaster casts, looking at maps and archives, and working with someone like Dirar Kalash, who's an incredible sound artist, and using sound also as a very important part of building a series of kind of a living archive where we can use physical objects, but also ephemeral work like sound to build an archive of evidence of what's happening in those archaeological sites. So it is a kind of a curation of objects, both physical and virtual.
Yeah, and there's so much to unpack there. I guess I want to maybe dive a little deeper, since we're on the radio, into how you use sound in your work. I remember when I was looking at your Depth Unknown project, and how you had these objects on of like representing archaeological sites, and within them they were also objects that emitted sound, and I was wondering if you could talk more about how you use sound in that project, what kinds of sounds are emitted, and what does the element of sound bring to this project.
So just a little background on Depth Unknown. It's a collective that we started in 2017, the end of 2017. It is a collective that has archaeologist Sylvia Truini in it, who is based in Palestine. Anthropologist advisor for our project was Nadia Abulhaj, who has helped us, especially in the last couple of years with our work for the Sharjah Architecture Triennial, and that I'll talk about in a second. But we also worked with part of our collective is Dirar Kalash, who I just mentioned. And we were commissioned to do an installation for the Sharjah Architecture Triennial in 2019 that was curated by Adrian Lahoud. And the idea for the project started after Sylvia and I were working on Sebastia, and we were really interested in what was happening there. Sebastia is an archaeological site northwest of Nablus that, similarly to what's happening in Silwan, it's starting to see a lot of violence from Israeli settlers burning trees and draining sewage water in the valleys and so on. But also the militarization of archaeology there is a big deal. So we have seen a lot of looting through the military, the IDF, in the middle of the night. We've seen the IDF coming to protect Israeli settlers as they come and use the archaeological space that is private land that Palestinian villagers there own, the residents of Sebastia. So what we were thinking about doing is, how do we archive what the events, the incidents and the events that are happening, that are very violent, that are happening there? And two is this kind of questioning of the archaeological discipline as a linear, that understands time as a linear space, or as a linear spectrum, if you will. So we were, you know, very critical of how archaeological sites are understood as singular, or the narrative embedded underground is understood as a singular narrative where Zionism can kind of be superimposed onto the ground without embracing multiple complex narratives at the same time. So this is what kind of the Israeli archaeologists were doing in Sebastia, but also the colonial archaeologists from earlier in 1910 were doing with Harvard University. That's a separate story. But the sound for us was a way to get the ground to speak. And the question was, how do we, you know, if the ground were able to speak its own truth, what would it sound like? So this is where Dirar came in. And what we did was go to Sebastia multiple times and actually embedded microphones into recorders into the ground itself in multiple locations. There are 12 archaeological monuments in Sebastia. Some of them are embedded underground that were reburied after excavation because they were considered not valuable enough for the colonial archaeologists that were trying to prove the Bible at the time. So, for example, Canaanite sites or like the Temple of Kore was reburied because it wasn't valuable enough. So we tried to actually put the speakers underground to see what it sounded like. But the interesting thing that we were able to get were some of the protests, some of the sound of the bulldozers that were went through, some of the also, you know, birds chirping in the background and people strolling through the archaeological site. And Dirar kind of used those 12 recordings to manipulate them in a way, work with them to create 12 soundtracks that were emitted from the installation that we had at the Sharjah Architectural Triennial. So you were able to kind of transport yourself into Sebastia and hear what the ground had to say.
Yeah, I love that. I remember when I was first like seeing your work and I came across that question, if the ground, like what would the ground say if the ground could talk? And I just had to stop for that moment and like really let that sink in, because I think that's an incredible question that you're asking and finding so many different ways to answer it through your work. So yeah. That's cool.
Thanks. It was fun.
Yeah. And then you touched on this a little bit, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the connection between archaeological and agricultural terrorism, because both those things happen at the site of Sebastia. So.
Yeah, there's a huge connection there, multiple levels. Maybe I can split it into two. Maybe talk about it from two different angles. I'm going to go back and talk about Sebastia because that's the case study that I know best. But hopefully, this is what we're doing with the studio also, is that at the Royal College of Art, we're starting with our case study on Sebastia this year. And then next year, we'll do a different case study and then build on from that every year moving forward. But starting with Sebastia, what we've realized so far is that the agricultural ecological terrorism that's happening in the site is not only happening today, but it was also the case 100 years ago. So you're talking about 100 years of abuse. And one way to think about this is, okay, let's go back to the first archaeological excavation in Sebastia, which was the one I mentioned in 1908. So it was funded by Jacob Henry Schiff, who was the Zionist funder was the director of the Semitic Museum at Harvard, and he was interested in funding this excavation because they wanted to, like I mentioned, prove the Bible, and biblical archaeology was just on the rise. So the excavation took place there for a couple of years, and what that looked like was hiring residents of Sebastia to do the excavation labor, including women and children. And all of the landowners of the archaeological sites were, obviously the archaeological site was underground, so the surface was actually olive groves and apricot trees and fig trees and so on. And there are records in the Harvard diaries that show you how many trees were cut down to actually be able to do the excavation. And there were disputes from the residents. There were also the kind of anecdotes in the diaries that you can go back to and see how the labor was so abusive. And so that's kind of the start of it. And hundreds of trees were cut back then. And then today, continuously since that day, what you see now is Israeli settlers that kind of established the Shavei Shomron settlement just across from Sebastia, as the idea of it is the return to Samaria, which Sebastia is ancient Samaria biblically. And what they are doing now is cutting hundreds and thousands of trees in the valleys that the Palestinian farmers own. They have two factories in the settlement. One is a cosmetic factory, the other is a leather factory, and all of the water is drained in the valleys. And Sebastia is known as one of the most impressive sites for wildflowers in Palestine. The wildflowers there, some of the most rare in the region, and they only bloom there. And you're starting to see a big difference in the number of species that exist in Sebastia, unfortunately. And it's obviously polluting the water table underground that the Palestinians usually use to irrigate their fields. So it's a huge economic crisis for the residents at the same time. And because of that, they're forced to find a plan B and a plan C for their work and for their lifestyle. So a lot of them are now working kind of by force, in a way that's very reminiscent to the past of forced labor and excavation. Now they're forced labor in working in the same factories that are actually polluting their ground, and also working to build further settlements because there's no other job to do in the region. So it's kind of a tragic story. And this is one of thousands of archaeological sites where almost exactly everything I just said is repeated in those areas as well. So this is one of many case studies that we should look into.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think that really feeds into my next question, which is about, I know you talk a lot about intergenerational trauma, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how archaeology can be a physical manifestation of that intergenerational trauma, and how you explore that through your work as well.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's something that I've been thinking about a lot in my practice, and I was just having a conversation with you just before this about this, and part of the reason that I, started my introduction kind of open and honest about what it meant to forage as a child growing up in Palestine. And sometimes now when I talk about, when I have lectures or when I talk about my work, I do start with a personal note for the first time ever, just this year. And I think part of that reason is because it feels more honest and more self-reflective in a way that I feel might be useful for the collective movement. It's something that I still struggle with because it is, I don't know, it's a little invasive, but also healing at the same time. So I'm still experimenting with how much I want to do this. But, I grew up in the Second Intifada. My house was bombed while we were inside. We were living under the staircase for a long period of that time. And so this relationship of the ground to safety and to security and to this obsession with collecting objects, kind of at the time they were grounding me. Like the idea of a rock also is something that I think about a lot today, and why I had a collection of rocks growing up. Part of that was because we also saw kids like Fadis Oude hold rocks and throw them at tanks and then later get killed for it. The material of stone as a facade and for the Palestinian domestic space, and thinking about how that facade is so easily dissolved. So those things, the materiality of stone, rocks, and the ground stay with you. And I still have, a basket of a bunch of the artifacts that I kept from that time. So we were forced to leave. And I think this idea of displacement also I think about a lot. So the displacement of the Palestinian people and diaspora, and even my generation who were born and raised in Palestine and then later left, and some of them are still leaving now because of economic situations and a bunch of other reasons. But also thinking about displaced objects and thinking about archaeological sites as a kind of extractive space that tens of thousands of artifacts are displaced from. You think about the body, my own body as a traumatized space, but also about the archaeological ground itself as a space of trauma that's layered with holes, right? It's like almost there are all these voids inside because they were reburied without the artifacts in them. And you can see in the diaries where archaeologists decided to rebury after removing the more valuable artifacts or monuments. And some of them were giant things. They're not just like little shards of pottery, but massive statues that were taken to multiple museums all over the world. And so thinking about those objects and displacement is kind of a reflection of myself, no? It's a series of displaced people and displaced objects kind of is what we're dealing with now. So the end of the story is, what does return look like for me and for the objects? And some of that is restitution, but also a spiritual healing in some way. And I think this movement over the last few months has led me to start thinking about the reflection of my work and why I'm doing it, why it looks like the way it does, and having open conversations with people about trauma, but also not being paralyzed by it and not kind of marrying myself to these like Western tropes of what trauma really means or PTSD. I don't really necessarily believe in that, but I do find it freeing to be open about the way that we talk about our work and to be honest about it, because it's somewhat freeing and liberating to talk about it in this way.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. I know that I asked for permission to ask this question because I know, like, I can see the difficulty of it, but I just want to thank you so much for answering that so open and honestly, because I think it is a really important story, and I feel really honored that you're sharing it with me and with the airwaves. Yeah, I just am going to sit with that for a second.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's actually not, I don't know, we're not paralyzed by it, right? It's like I always think about actually this idea of nostalgic paralysis. And I think my parents' generation, at least, is paralyzed by nostalgia because they create this imaginary space of, or my parents grew up in Palestine, but a lot of the diaspora build this nostalgic, mythical idea of what Palestine is. So actually thinking about this, or getting over this trauma by imagining return is not that emotional. It is emotional, but it's not pessimistic. It's actually a very optimistic viewpoint, and also encourage a lot of people on a daily basis to just like experience return in some way, either physically or through their own practice. And you know, that's why I moved back to Palestine in 2016 after being abroad for 15 years. Yeah, it's time to go home.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess to go back a little bit to your work, I've been thinking a lot about hollow forms coming into this broadcast, and I haven't exactly known how to ask you about it because you've talked about it so much. And but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the I can't remember what you call them, but the ones that are exact replicas of
ghosts,
exactly, if you could talk a little bit more about that. And
that's actually the perfect segue to hollow forms. So hollow forms is the contemporary glass collection that I've been working with the Twam family in Jabah. It's a village in northwest of Jerusalem that's actually on behind the wall, so it's within basically Ramallah now. And they've been working on glass for decades. They're incredible craftsmen. So I met them, like I said, when I was working with Riwaq. And And when I started looking at the history of glass, I realized that there were 10,000 artifacts that are displaced in museums that came from Palestine and donated by anonymous and so on, at, you know, at the V&A here in London, at the Met in New York. And I became obsessed with this idea of contemporary forgeries and thinking about forms of restitution beyond the legal framework of restitution and what that looked like. So I replicated 25 of the glass vessels that are displaced and did that with very clear translucent glass. So it's not colored. It's just like a clear glass. And with the Thuam family, we replicated them 25 of them exactly to the detail and to the same dimension. And exhibited them in Amman Design Week in Jordan. So it was really nice to exhibit the pieces that exist in, you know, the real ones kind of exist in different institutions globally, but bring them all kind of home to Jordan. And maybe hopefully I'll exhibit them in Palestine at some point. That would be fun. Was really nice and liberating. And the bigger part of that story isn't just a replication of the pieces, but also being able to talk about the using the vessels themselves as a form to tell the history of glass in Palestine. So there is this really long history of glass in Palestine that is forgotten. And part of it is actually about the minerals that exist in the rivers in Palestine. So, for example, there's Nahr al-Na'min and the Balus River in south of the city of Akka. And it was really high in minerals, like silica and so on. So actually, it was a healing space. We're talking about thousands of years ago. And people used to go to pray to this river because it was really high in silica and high in rich in minerals. But it was also, the sand was also used as the material to create glass, and it was Akka was a manufacturing manufacturing hub for glass, and the sand was melted in large furnaces that some archaeological excavations in their surveys you can see some of the leftovers of the furnaces with that were made out of mud bricks, and you still see like a glaze that's left behind from the manufacturing of glass. And they were kind of, the slab of glass that was melted in this furnace was cut up into cubes, and then it was moved to Saida in Lebanon, to Egypt. And you can kind of trace the history of glass in the region that is forgotten. And the people used plant ash to color the glass, seashells to color the glass. And, you know, there is this misrepresentation of the history of glass as like a Roman material, or as even like Murano is the biggest hub of glass in the world now. But a part of the hub was Palestine. And kind of bringing that history back through the exhibition was really fun.
Yeah. And I think that also connects. I apologize again. I should have memorized the names of them, but the ones
abstract names.
Where you were trying to make abstract objects, and then you ended up, based on what you see in the landscape, and then you ended up finding similar objects.
Oh yeah.
I thought that was the most interesting.
Oh yeah.
Thing, relationship, and that makes me also think a lot about how. With archaeology, the act of an archaeological site is almost like we are digging here because we are at a different time than we were then. And so we are looking at, it's okay, no worries. We're looking at the past, you know, like we're looking at the past from a different people. And I felt like the way that you described like making these objects, thinking you were making something new and seeing them in the continuous past, not a fragmented
right
box
yeah
past. I don't know,
yeah, that was an accident. That was kind of fun. So you're talking about the Alienation collection, which is this blue collection that I made that I thought was very abstract and like using the form of a tree or a cactus or whatever. I was just doodling in the sitting outside my house and doodling, and kind of ended up creating a collection based on those doodles, which I'm, you know, a lot of I don't know, it was like a very casual process. And it was my first collection with the Twam family. And it was blue. The whole point of it was that we're kind of honoring this Hebron blue, because Hebron is one of the biggest glass centers in the region, and it's still thriving. And so I wanted to honor Hebron through this collection. So it was the entirely blue collection. It's an incredible blue. It's kind of like the Klein blue. So I wasn't really paying attention to the forms, honestly, that much. I was just like being abstract about the way that we were blowing them. But a lot of it was also experimental on the spot with the glass blowers. And they changed a lot of it based on like the physics and the chemistry of how glass works as a material. And of course, you know, it's a collaborative process. If it's not just me giving them dimensions or images and them replicating it, it's very much a conversation in the workshop with Abu Marwan and Marwan and the family. So after I exhibited them, I was speaking to, actually a few years after I showed them, I was speaking to an archaeologist that specializes in glass and glass history. And she was like, oh yeah, I was on your website and I saw the alienation, which to me was the most directly linked to archaeology and to the history of glass. And I was like, what are you talking about? They were just doodles. And she said a few of them, like the really bulbous ones with tails, looked like some of the forms that were also blown in Islamic tradition in the region. Islamic glass blowing kind of looked very similar, which I hadn't even done the research really at the time. So I think part of that is the agency that the glass blowers had, and this like intuitive relationship of the body, the breath, and the material that ends up kind of looking similar to some of the archaeological artifacts that you still find in Palestine today. It's kind of amazing.
I love that. Yeah, I think a lot about the body in my work, and so I think that's such an astute observation, that just like we are still bodies making forms with similar ways, like methods, like we are still using heat and breath in our bodies, and therefore we make similar things. I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, there's something also about glass blowing, because it's, you know, there is a relationship, for example, in ceramics, there's definitely a relationship of the hand to the making of the object. But in glass, you're talking about a human breath that's kind of creating this physical form. And the movement of the human breath basically decides what this thing looks like. And sometimes it depends on how tired you are that day that the form is going to look different, because you have to have this like lung capacity to be able to blow. So there's this very deep connection between the human body and the spirit and the human breath in relation to glass. And I can't wait to continue making more and see what else we come up with. I'm learning from the glass blowers as much as I can, but they have 30 more years experience than I do.
I'm so excited to see what you do, because I'm so excited to follow you.
Thank you so much. And thanks for the host
of
hosting
course.
Me.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dima. You it's can find fun. Her at dimasuji.com, right?
Yep. Instagram.
Yeah. See Instagram.
And similar. We'll launch the Holoforms shop soon, so keep an eye out for that.
Yeah. I was looking on your website and I was dreaming about buying one. <That's sweet. laughs> One day.
Yeah. Well, we have a smaller collection that I think is quite accessible. Okay. Like homeware as well as sculpture. So there's something for everybody.
Yeah, I'll look into that one. All right, so we are going to move into Yazan Khalili.
Hi, Yazan.
Who isn't here, unfortunately. We are listening to Listening to the Land, which is a collection of recordings where recorded music where the land is the instrument and part of the music, which I think is the most beautiful follow-up to this conversation, where we're thinking about what the land would say if the land could talk. So let's get into that.